Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Karen Armstrong is here. Karen Armstrong is a former Catholic nun who left the Covenant some 20 years ago. She has become well known ever since about her writings on the history of religion. She's the author of such books as A History of God and her latest, it's called Fields of Blood, Religion and the History of Violence. Karen Armstrong, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to this radio station.
Thank you very much.
Now, the premise in your book, and we've talked about this a few months ago, is about this idea that religion is violent is somewhat of a misnomer, that the state has a monopoly on violence and that the state will use religion to justify violence, maybe to spur others to commit acts of violence. But it's the state that has a monopoly on violence. And I think this would be an interesting spot to begin our conversation with what's happening today in Old Jerusalem. A lot of conflict happening again around the Al-Aqsa compound. You have the mosque, one of the most sacred sites for Muslims. You also have the temple wall, one of the most sacred sites for the Jewish people. It's interesting, and I thought about, let's start here after I was reading in your book, and you wrote about during the Crusades, even the Knight Templars set up in the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which was a big deal.
Yes, the Knight Templar had their headquarters in the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and the Dome of the Rock was turned into a church. Called the Temple of the Lord. They thought that this had been the temple where Jesus had prayed, this Muslim shrine. And then the Knights Templar actually had their horses right on the mosque, right there. So,
and that was a big deal, having the horses.
Well, that was like their tanks, you know. Right. That was their weaponry. So they were the people who were the chief military arm of the whole of the Crusader states. This is always a sensitive area, and it's a holy place. When I was studying the history of Jerusalem, one found again and again and again that people identify with a holy place at a very profound level. When they visit a holy place, they not only have an encounter with the divine, but also with themselves. And the rituals and everything just very much mirror what is going on in people's minds and hearts. This Arab-Israeli conflict began on both sides as a purely secular conflict about a land. On both sides, it was driven by national interests. The Zionist movement was aggressively secular. They felt that religious Judaism had encouraged Jews to just give in to persecution. And Herzl was horrified when he visited the Western Wall and saw the Jews praying and crying and weeping at the wall, clinging to the stones. He said, this is exactly what we've got to get rid of. He wanted Jews to be like Israelis today, in fact, strong, tough, upright, not snivelling and beseeching the deity as he saw it. And he said if he had his way, he wrote in his diary, he'd pull the whole thing down, the whole of the old city down.
He's a prominent Zionist.
He's the founder of Zionism. And build a new Jerusalem, modern Jerusalem outside the walls. And nobody, the first Zionists, they were not very interested in Jerusalem. But that changed in 1967. The attack by the Arab world during the Six-Day War revived all terrible fears of Holocaust. Nasser was said to have vowed to throw them all into the sea. And instead, of course, it was a staggering victory, Israeli victory. And the turnaround was such a new holiness, a new religious enthusiasm entered Zionism. And on the day of they conquered the wall, you had these tough paratroopers, their faces blackened by contact, all clinging to the wall, just as Herzl had seen them, and weeping. In the wall, they also saw themselves. The wall had been a survivor like themselves, just as Jews had founded Israel out of the concentration camps.
This is where the great temple was.
It was a part of Herod's temple, the supporting wall of Herod's temple. It had survived all these centuries, and they felt that they had returned to themselves, as it were, to an important part of themselves. And the word holiness suddenly started to be on everybody's lips. And Jerusalem, they vowed it would never again, would they give it back. So the encounter with a holy place can spark very, very profound feelings. And now on the Palestinian side, what you'll see, the holy city with this third holiest site in the Muslim world, now surrounded, all the hills of Jerusalem surrounded by big, impressive Israeli settlements. And they feel the city slipping daily from their grasp. The city has become a symbol of their beleaguered identity, hemmed in on all sides, hopeless, and a sort of a new, periodically, a new desperation comes in. And so deep is this identification that very often when the holy place is attacked, people have experienced it way back in biblical times as a rape, as something that was is absolutely crucial to their identity has been violated in some way. So when there's a political conflict, this place has always been a bit of a tinderbox.
Tell me the importance of this mosque to Muslims. What's the story behind it?
Well, it's a very interesting story. When the Christians owned Jerusalem, and it's a story that this should be known more clearly. The Christians of Byzantium had owned Jerusalem for hundreds of years, and they were conquered by the Muslim armies in 637. And 638, the Caliph Umar entered the city as a conqueror, but instead of appearing in splendid robes, this was early Islam, he rode on a camel in his very threadbare clothes, and they were showing him round the city. Now, the Quran speaks of the great mosque, a praying place, a place for prayer, where rebuilt by the Prophet Solomon, whom they honour. And this was the city of the great prophets. They were very excited to be in Jerusalem. And they showed the caliph around the city. And while they were in the Holy Sepulchre Church, the chief Christian church, the time for Muslim prayer came round. And the caliph said, "I must pray." And they said, "Please pray where you are, beside the tomb of Christ." He said, "No." And he went outside into the public street and made his prostrations there. He came back and said, "Look, if I had prayed in this church, some misguided Muslims in the future might have wanted to tear this place down and build a mosque to celebrate the first Islamic prayer in Jerusalem." Mm. And he at once signed a charter to say that Christians must keep their holy places and buildings absolutely intact because they honour the Christian faith. But then he kept asking where the temple was. "Where's the temple? Where's the mosque that we've heard so much about? Where's Solomon's temple?" And the Byzantines were embarrassed. Since the Romans had destroyed the temple in the year 70, the ruins had been left as they were, as a symbol. Christians saw it as a symbol of the defeat of Judaism by Christianity. And in recent years, it had been used as the city garbage dump. So eventually, they have to come clean, and Omar makes his way up to the Temple Mount, and he's horrified. And immediately, he starts gathering the garbage up and clearing it, and his followers do the same. And they reconsecrated the place. And Jews, by this time, had said that only the Messiah could build the temple. They had no desire to build a temple themselves. Only the Messiah could come. And there was Jews in the 7th century who said that the Muslims were the precursors of the Messiah. They had reconstituted the place and made it ready for his return. And Jews had never, under Christian rule, been allowed to live in Jerusalem. They were allowed to visit it once a year on the feast on the 9th of Av, but otherwise they were excluded from the whole of Judea. And Omar invited the Jewish communities back, and they lived side by side by the small Muslim community at the foot of the Haram al-Sharif. This was originally honoured as the site of Solomon's temple, and later, a legend grew up that the Prophet Muhammad, who'd made a a mystical ascent, and he'd come to Jerusalem.
After he died?
No,
while he was still alive.
Yeah, in a vision. I mean, it was a sort of visionary experience. His wife said that when he left his bed, he just knocked off his the drinking cup beside his bed, and when he returned after his long trip, it was just falling to the ground. This was a mystical vision, but it's a very wonderful because it shows the pluralism of Islam. The Prophet arrives and has flown on a miraculous steed to Jerusalem, and there he's met by all the prophets of the past, who don't sneer at him and say, "Who do you think you are, upstart?" They ask him to preach, and they listen to him, and he calls them brother. And then he starts his ascent through the seven heavens, at each point meeting the prophets of the past, Jesus and John the Baptist, Moses and Aaron, and finally Abraham, the favourite prophet of the Quran in the divine sphere. And it is a story of pluralism. This is an archetypal tale of Muslim piety. And here the prophets acknowledge one another. They ask advice. Muhammad asks Moses, "How many times do you think Muslims should pray every day?"
And he said five?
No, he said he was thinking of 10. And Moses said, "Don't even go there. You know, this is way too ambitious. I would say 3 maximum." And so he, on the way down, after he'd been to the throne of God, Moses said, "How did you get on?" And he said, "It's 5. But they ask each other's advice. They listen to one another. And this story of pluralism is enshrined in this flight of the Prophet. It's the archetypal tale of Muslim spirituality, the return to the source that is God, to which we must all, make. They believe that the Prophet landed from heaven on this stone, and Muslim devotions follow the Prophet's journey that night, the place where he preached, the place where he tied his horse. Very much walking in the footsteps of the Prophet, just as outside Christians follow in the footsteps of Jesus on the Via Dolorosa on his way to the cross.
So obviously this is before the Crusades.
This is before the Crusades. The Crusades arrive 600 years later. What's interesting about the Crusades, I think, is this. We have a feeling here that Islam is an inherently violent faith. And the Crusaders arrived in Jerusalem. This is the third holiest city in the Muslim world. And in 2 days, they massacre the entire population. 5 months later, they'd still not managed to bury all the bodies, and the place absolutely reeked. It was a catastrophe. The Arab chroniclers who described this event were appalled. They had been embroiled with all the great powers of the region, but they'd never seen such fighting as this, utter merciless killing. It had always, war had been conducted within, as it were, the Hague Conventions, within certainly clearly defined principles. But they never assumed that this was a holy war for Christians. They saw it simply as a war of conquest. And you'd think that after this start, 9/11 would be a pinprick compared with what the Muslim world would get. There would be an absolute concerted, not a bit of it. For 50 years, the Christians lived in little principalities which they set up in the Near East, including the Kingdom of Jerusalem. They were our first Western colonies. And the local emirs went on fighting one another for land and territory, and they made treaties with the Christians and fought alongside them. There was no concerted attempt to get rid of them. Jihad was dead in the region. It was not until they suddenly saw shoals of new crusades coming from the West that they started thinking, these guys have got to go. But still, it took Nur ad-Din and Salah ad-Din 30 years after that to revive the jihad. It was hard work. It was hard propaganda work. The lesson we have to learn from this is that the jihad was dead. It's never quite left the region. And it was revived by a sustained assault from the West. Again, these lessons of history should make us pause and look at things in a different light.
Again, looking at this notion that religion is violent, and there have been many religious wars, and oftentimes people will point to the Crusades as the example. You write in your book, Fields of Blood, Religion and the History of Violence, that Pope Urban II, who called for the Crusade, it was about much more
politics
than just religious conquest.
We never go to war for a single reason. Whatever the ideology, there's all historians of warfare tell us there are always multiple factors involved, and that politics is essential. Politics and religion were absolutely fused in everybody's mind until about the year 1700, and that only in Europe. Only in Europe then did we separate religion and politics in this way. No, Pope Urban's ambition, he was using the Crusade as a way to assert his supremacy over the princes and kings. He was taking their prerogative. They were supposed to be the ones who called for war.
Princes and kings in Europe.
In Europe, yes. And they were fighting to see who would be top dog in Europe. The Pope wanted to do it, they were aiming to build a papal monarchy. And his aim, too, was to extend the power of the Western Church into the Eastern Church, into Byzantium. The emperor of Byzantium had asked for help against the Turks. So in sending a huge army, he was asserting the might of the Western Church. It was deeply political.
But the story is that we're coming to help the Christians of Byzantium.
These were certainly there in people's minds, and certainly the Crusaders thought that they were going to save the land of their Lord Jesus, just as they would fight for the land of their feudal lord. But they were all mixed up with politics. And after that, the wars on the Crusader side got more and more secular. So Salah ad-Din, when he is fighting Richard the Lionheart, he's revived jihad, and so they're all reciting hadith on the Muslim side and praying for the success of the city. And Richard promises his men a gold piece for every brick of the city wall that they tear down, an entirely secular motivation given to those. By the end of the Crusades, it mattered far more the political outcome of the Crusades at home in Europe, the impact that the Crusade had made on the internal affairs of Europe were far more important than what had actually happened in the Holy Land.
So was it just for the jockeying of position of who the most powerful figure
exactly.
was?
Exactly. It was a good idea to lead a crusade. You got a lot of clout at home if you did that. And so, and you have the spectacle of Frederick II, who leads the Sixth Crusade. He's excommunicated by the Pope. So you get this excommunicated emperor in a travesty of the Crusade going across and making peace with the Sultan. They don't want to fight. They sign a treaty, and he gets a bit of Jerusalem back and goes home. But he wanted to make his mark I am the savior of Jerusalem. It was very good political clout to have in Europe.
Again, we are in conversation with Karen Armstrong. She is the author of the book, Fields of Blood, Religion and the History of Violence. She has written a number of books on the history of religion, including the best-selling A History of God. Karen Armstrong, you write that it was Constantine in the 300s who really is responsible to employ religion to state violence.
Because religion in the pre-modern world permeated all activities, including statecraft and warfare, all politics was imbued with religion. But Jesus had been, as far as we know, an anti-imperialist. Then when Constantine, who was some sort of Christian, became world emperor, emperor of Byzantium, you have imperial Christianity, almost a complete contradiction of the original message of Jesus. And that this happened too in Islam. Islam is all about equality and justice and the importance of sharing wealth. And then they create an empire. And the whole point of an empire is that there has to be a small aristocracy suppressing 90% of the population. That was the only way people managed to create civilization on this structural violence. No state, however peaceable it proclaims itself to be, can ever afford to disband its army.
Could it be argued that maybe the natural progression of a religion is to form some type of a state that would then employ violence?
Yes, not always, though. Not all religions achieve that. The Confucians, for example, remained in government, but they could never prevail against the violence of the Chinese Empire. An empire is sustained by violence, and it is established by violence, and no state can disband its army ever. So there have always been people who rose up against this and called for justice, like the prophets of Israel, Jesus himself. They could never prevail against the might of the state. Historians of warfare tell us that without civilization would not endure without peaceful, well-regulated armies.
You write about Ashoka.
Yes.
And Ashoka's dilemma. Who was Ashoka?
I wanted to call my book Ashoka's Dilemma, but the publishers wouldn't have it, of course. Ashoka was the first emperor.
Because Fields of Blood will just sell a lot more.
Well, it's also, Fields of Blood is also not just about a gruesome bloodthirstiness. It's also laying bare the violence of the agrarian empire. Sometimes we look back on the pre-industrial age when agriculture was the source of the economy, as though people were living closer to nature. But really, the book takes that apart because the agrarian empire was inherently violent, like all empires, and subjugated most of the population. But Ashoka came to the throne in the 3rd century BCE. He was the first emperor to rule the whole of India. And he came to the throne after killing two of his brothers. He was not averse to violence, and for the first 8 years of his reign, he built up quite a reputation for cruelty. Then, on one day, he accompanied the army on a military expedition, and he was absolutely appalled by what he saw. He saw the mountains of corpses. He saw the prisoners of war who were being taken away for forced labor, torn away from their families. And he had a sort of conversion. He set up throughout his realm great huge inscriptions on cliff faces and towering pillars, which were unearthed during the 19th century and translated, urging the people to peace and compassion. He said that if kings had to go to war, they must keep atrocities down to an absolute minimum. He himself is going to give up hunting, which is a cruel sport, and replacing it with royal pilgrimages to Buddhist shrines. He's going to set up schools and clinics. He urges everybody to listen to all teachers, whoever they are, even those deemed heretical, like the Buddhists and the Jains, and listen respectfully to their teachings. But he could never disband his army. Because had he done so, and he went on with the conquests, had he done so, all the wannabe emperors would start fighting one another for power, and there would just be anarchy. Ironically, a powerful empire was the best way of keeping the peace. That's why they called it the Pax Romana. The Roman Empire was called the Pax Romana. It has established peace, but with huge, massive force and violence. And sustained it. Ashoka's dilemma is the dilemma of civilization and the dilemma of us all. We dream of peace. We dream of creating a golden age, just as the Zionists did when they went to Palestine first. They were going to create a socialist utopia where there would be justice and equality for all. But somehow the mechanics of our civilization seem to demand violence. We are violent creatures.
I would imagine if Ashoka were to undo his military, not only would the other smaller kingdoms fight amongst each other, they'd overtake his own.
Oh, yes.
Power in his own throne.
Oh, that
by violent act.
All of them. There would have been mayhem. Everything would have gone down until one new one had come on top by killing all the others.
Let's talk more about Islam. You hit on this earlier. I think many people, at least in the mainstream, are unaware that it is a religion that is very much about social justice and equality among people.
That is the bedrock message of the Quran.
I mean, that's it.
That's it. That's all it's saying. That it is wrong to build up a private fortune, good to share your wealth equally, and to create a just and decent society where the poor and vulnerable are treated with respect. The word jihad and its derivatives is mentioned only 47 times in the Quran, and only 10 of those instances does it refer unequivocally to warfare. The word jihad means effort, struggle, endeavor. And sometimes it's a struggle to give somebody food when you have very little yourself, someone who's worse off. That is a jihad. That's the predominant message of the Quran. Muslims, as we've seen, when Omar took Jerusalem, there was no fighting of other faiths. There's a passage in the Quran where God takes Muhammad to task. He says, look, Muhammad is upset because more people aren't joining his community, his ummah. And God says, look, if it had been our will to have you all in the whole of mankind into one single ummah, we would have arranged it like that. But this was not our will. In other words, religious pluralism is God's will. There's a pluralism in the Quran that we certainly don't find in the Bible.
People will point out, though, that Muhammad even led raids against other people.
Yes, and this was this was a sort of an economic necessity. What happened? The Muslim community in Mecca was thrown. They had to leave Mecca. They were being persecuted there. They took root in Medina, up in the north. And that they were a complete drain on the community. The food was an absolute scarcity in Arabia. They were all living on the brink of malnutrition. And Medina was a rare agricultural colony, but all the available land was taken. And the people from Mecca, they were businessmen, financiers and bankers. They didn't know anything about farming. There was no land for them to farm. And the Meccan Medina now had to feed this. Now, the fail-safe in the Arabian Peninsula in times of scarcity had always been to make a raid on a neighbouring tribe. It was a kind of national sport. You raided your neighbour, took off his camp, took away food and camels, taking care not to kill anybody because that would cause a vendetta. So it was a sort of, the game was to get the camels and not to injure anybody. So this, and no one thought this was at all reprehensible. It was just a sort of terribly rough and ready way of circulating scarce resources. So Muhammad said, we have to go on a raid because we have to bring something into the community. They can't support us like this. And they were hopeless at it first because the Qurayshis hadn't been raiding for generations, and the first raids were absolute disasters. They also had to defend themselves because Mecca was determined to wipe out and exterminate the Muslim community. But as soon as the Prophet, the tide had slightly turned in his favour, Muhammad initiated a policy of non-violence. He rode with his followers during the Hajj month of the pilgrimage to Mecca, unarmed, with his followers of pilgrims.
And the pilgrims were unarmed as well. Everybody was unarmed
into Mecca, and the Meccans sent the cavalry out to kill them all. And the friendly Bedouin guided them into the Meccan sanctuary, where all violence was forbidden within the radius of the Quran. And he said, now we sit down and wait. And the Meccans were going to still exterminate them, but then they thought and they took advice. And eventually the diplomat arrived to make peace. And Muhammad signed a treaty, which the Muslims, pilgrims, were horrified by, because they said, it's given away all we've gained with all this. He just said, certainly whatever you want, we'll do it. And On the way home, everyone's very dejected. The army is almost, the Muslims are always mutinying. They're so upset. And a message comes down from God to say this was a supreme victory. And indeed, the tide turned. After that, people started coming to Islam, and 2 years later, Mecca opened its gates voluntarily. Military historians tell us that the Prophet, in uniting the whole of Arabia under him, which had been a whole war, he did it mostly by diplomacy. And he must be one of the few people to have built an empire more by diplomacy than by warfare. And the same was true of the first caliphs. When they went out, many, they took Damascus and Cairo and Egypt. They gave them good terms, and they made a peace without fighting.
This is the early spread of Islam.
This is the early spread of Islam.
Done largely without fighting.
There was fighting, but military historians note that a significant amount of it was done by diplomacy. They got the hang of violence later, like any empire, and started invading. And because
you trace that to the Umayyad dynasty.
The Umayyads, yes, they started it, and then the Abbasids.
Sort of the first and the civilization of the Muslims,
yes.
The Umayyad, then the Abbasids after that.
Yes, yeah. That's right.
One term here in this country that always has a negative aspect whenever it's said, and it's not really even questioned or explained, is that of Sharia law.
Yes.
Of Islamic law.
Yes.
Tell me about what is Sharia law?
Well, Sharia law, the word Sharia means it's an old word. It meant the path to the watering hole. In the desert, there would be an established path to the watering hole. And if you diverged from that, it was really bad news. So it's a symbolic path to the source of life. Now, the Abbasid caliphs would set up an aristocracy, very little to do with the Quran, which is all about equality, but the aristocracy was an essential part of the agrarian setup. And without it, historians say, without the small aristocracy, we wouldn't have advanced beyond a primitive level, because it created a leisured class with the leisure to pursue the arts and sciences on which our progress depended. So the Abbasids had a very sophisticated court. They had their own code. The adab, which was a courtly manners and literature, arts, clearly not applicable to the vast mass of the population. So they asked the clergy, the ulama, to compile a law on the Quran, and they did so. And the Sharia law, in its origins, it's a countercultural protest. It says that no one person can rule. It stresses the notion of absolute equality, and it is a sort of countercultural, counter-imperial alternative set up. The caliphs had to acknowledge it, but they couldn't rule by it. You couldn't just any more than Ashoka could rule by this way. So it was never the law of the land until the Ottomans made it so. When they created their empire in the 16th century. But it shouldn't be seen as something like the Ten Commandments with a whole lot of die-hard laws. It's very much sort of a system of jurisprudence, giving principles on which Islamic judges will rule cases about, say, divorce, for example, or indeed statecraft. So it's very much like case law that, you know, you establish a precedent but it was interesting. It was always a peaceable alternative to the iron rule of the caliphs at the very beginning.
I had it explained to me once about Sharia law. He said, oftentimes we only think about harsh punishments, cutting off the hands for stealing. But what this one person told me, that sort of opened my eyes, is that you have to understand that's in the context of Sharia law also says that everyone's basic needs must be met.
Yes, exactly. And there's been a wonderful book written about this showing that throughout the centuries, the ulama would perform huge exegetical feats to stop these harsh punishments. and introduce a more lenient atmosphere. Enjoy, you know, with legal backing to do this. So it's and they, everybody who knows what they're talking about knows that Sharia law was based on the agrarian system, like the Talmud. Like all pre-modern, it was based on an agrarian economy, and which is not applicable to one based on technology and industry, as our modern civilization, which is based on the constant replication by industry of resources and the constant reinvestment of capital. So if Sharia law were to be introduced, it would have to undergo a massive revision in order to be viable in the world. It's popular now in the Middle East because that countercultural aspect remains. And there's a lot of very dicey rulers in the Middle East. A lot of bad rules, many of them supported by the United States. And
yeah, I heard and anything that has nothing to do with the United States is something we support. Yeah. I've heard like a sentiment from the region.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that the idea with these people languishing under bad rule, Sharia law, which is against sort of this kind, has become very popular. And these punishments, they are utterly appalling to us. But, you know, in Britain, we didn't just cut off a thief's hand, we killed him.
Yeah.
Or deported him to the colonies for life. With these spectacles, which of course are utterly abhorrent to us, were essential to the running of a pre-modern state.
But as you know, there will be people who will argue that that's true, but that was happening in Britain several hundred years ago. We're seeing some of these things happening.
And of course, you know, what you're seeing in, say, Saudi Arabia, for example, this is utterly decried from the very beginning by the Muslim Brotherhood, for example. Said you can't have this in the modern world now.
The beheadings and
all this public stuff going. They're going. The Saudis have espoused a very maverick form of Islam. It's called Wahhabism. Goes back only to the 18th century.
It's a new form.
It's an entirely new, entirely uncharacteristic. It is against any development that occurred in Islam after the time of the Prophet. So Sunni, the Sunnah of the Prophet, Muslim law, Muslim philosophy, Sufism, the mysticism of Islam, which has such a wonderful appreciation of other faiths, that's all apostate stuff.
This and is, Sufism used to be the major.
Sufism was the form of Islam most popular among the people. Not everybody could be a mystic, but the Sufi exercises, the Sufi devotions, as well as the Sufi attitude to other faiths. Sufis have a very fine tradition of appreciating other faiths. It's quite outstanding. It's quite common for a Sufi mystic to cry in ecstasy that he's neither a Jew, a Christian, or a Muslim. He's at home equally in a synagogue, a mosque, a temple, or a church, because once you've glimpsed the divine, you've left these man-made distinctions behind. And there's one wonderful quotation that I like to end my speeches with sometimes, because it's by Ibn Arabi, a great Sufi philosopher and mystic. And this was the kind of attitude that would have been prevalent before the Saudis were able to impose their particular negative form of Islam on the Muslim world with the backing of the United States and Europe. Yes. Here he is. He's saying, "Do not praise your own faith so exclusively that you disbelieve all the rest. If you do this, you will miss much good. Nay, you'll fail to appreciate the real truth of the matter. God, the omnipresent and omniscient, cannot be confined to any one creed. For he says in the Quran, 'Wheresoever ye turn, there is the face of Allah.' Everybody praises what he knows. His God is his own creature, and in praising it, he praises himself. Consequently, he blames the beliefs of others, which he would not do if he were just, but his dislike is based on ignorance."
Again, we are in conversation with Karen Armstrong. She is the author of the book Fields of Blood, Religion and the History of Violence. In our remaining minutes together, has the Sufi base shrunk over the years?
Yes,
is it smaller?
They're very much...
Why is that?
The Saudis don't like it at all. They don't like the Shia and they don't like Sufism. We had a wonderful... I'm a trustee of the British Museum back in London, and we had a marvellous exhibition on the Hajj. Pilgrimage to Mecca. And I, for the catalogue, I was asked to write the opening introduction on pilgrimage as a world phenomenon, a pilgrimage in all religions. When we showed it to the Saudi embassy, they asked that we took out all reference to Sufism, all reference to Shiism, all reference to Buddhism even, which is, they say, is an atheistic religion. They'd have liked to say all reference to Islam, Judaism and Christianity, but they couldn't quite go that far. And we had to say absolutely no. But that is the anti-Sufi root of the...
So is Wahhabism born out of an anti-Sufi sentiment? Because, again,
it was an attempt. Rather like Luther and Calvin wanted to go back to when they reformed the church, they wanted to chuck out all this medieval nonsense that had accrued, in their view, all these rituals and things that had no base in the gospel, and go right back to the gospel and to the fathers of the church. Let's go back to the early church. The Wahhabis were trying to do the same. They were to say, let's go back to the prophet. They were very disturbed by the veneration of Sufi saints. People would come to the tombs and pray and of a great Sufi saint like Ibn Arabi and pray. And so those shrines were all obliterated, rather as the Puritans knocked down shrines and statues and things in Europe. And they have... they've managed to export this with their vast petrodollars. Right. All over the Muslim world. So a whole generation since the Iranian Revolution has grown up with this very, very negative, very narrow view of Islam. And people don't know, young Muslims, they are not taught the great philosophers of Islam, the great scientists of Islam, as well as the great mystics.
Much scientific advancement happened during the...
Indeed, during
Umayyad and Abbasid.
During the Abbasid period, yeah. There were more scientific discoveries than had been achieved in the whole of prehistory before that point. And it was through Muslim learning that Europe recovered the knowledge of the Greek science... Greek mathematics, Greek medicine, they learnt it from the Muslims in Cordova. All this learning, the Greek learning, classical learning, had been lost during what the period often known as the Dark Ages after the fall of the Roman Empire in the Western provinces. And it was we recovered it during the time of the Crusades. So while some Europeans were killing Muslims in the Middle East, others were going to Spain and studying under the Muslim scholars and learning from these Arabic speakers about science, about their own heritage.
I mean, even today, many of our scientific words come from Arabic, algebra.
Algebra, for example, obvious. Arithmetic, yes, this all Arabic terms.
Even chess, the game chess, yes, we have, thanks
that's
to the
right.
Arabs.
That's right.
Yeah. Karen Armstrong, 40 years ago, you'll correct me if my timeline's wrong. You were a Catholic nun.
Yes.
Are you still religious today? Are you writing about all these religions?
Yeah. I don't belong to any one creed, as rather Ibn Arabi suggested. I study them all. I can't see any one of them as superior to any of the other. Each has its own particular genius and each its particular vulnerabilities and Achilles' heels and failings. But I spend my days when I'm at home writing, thinking, or with you speaking about these matters. So I'm preoccupied by religion.
We were preoccupied by the visit of Pope Francis just a few weeks ago. What is your sense about the Pope?
Well, I never thought I would hear myself say these words, but I am absolutely delighted with what the Pope is doing at the moment. This is a real breath of fresh air. I think he's taken everybody surprise, including the College of Cardinals. I'm not sure that they were expecting this at all. But as soon as I was watching the television, waiting for, you know, they were just going to announce it, and I heard his name was going to be Francis, and I thought, this is different.
Francis
no
of
Pope
Assisi?
Has ever taken the name of Francis the poor man, who's renounced all the trappings of the imperial trappings that the papacy had acquired over the years. He lives in a three-star hotel apartment suite with other priests, not in the palace. He's done wonderful work in bringing out, airing all these awful scandals that were swept under the carpet with child abuse, starting disciplined tribunals to find out exactly what happened and to bring people for justice. He's also master of the gesture. And we started with Israel-Palestine. When he went to Israel-Palestine, he visited Yad Vashem, the Holocaust memorial. And he went and laid his head in contrition against the wall of Yad Vashem in sorrow for what mankind has done, including the Christian Church, has done to Jews over the centuries. Hmm. He then went to the Western Wall, as we mentioned earlier, the last relic of Herod's temple, where Jews congregate to weep and pray. And he went like as a Jew would and leant his head in contrition against the stones of this wall. Then Mr. Netanyahu and the security officers took him to the wall they'd built between Israel and Palestine. And they were explaining that this huge wall had stopped a lot of the terrorism. And he just walked across and leant his head in contrition and sorrow against that wall too.
Hmm.
And wham, you could see the Israelis, this was not on the schedule. But that photograph went right through the Middle East. His predecessor, Pope Benedict, had not been a favorite in the Muslim world after his very ill-judged few words about Islam. This changed overnight.
And did you ever think that there would be a pope that would stand up in the United States Congress and bring up the name of Thomas Merton?
Yes.
Or a number of other names
he
brought up. I know you've talked about Thomas Merton.
Well, Thomas Merton was a great American Trappist monk who was able to speak wonderfully about spirituality. And I quoted him in my book because he talks about systemic violence. A violence that isn't all about warfare or armies, but when violence is inflicted on people by the system in which they live. And when and he said that anybody who profits in any way from such a system is implicated in that. So I think that is a very important statement that for us to make right now. We often hold ourselves sort of rather holier than thou. We've got established our wonderful civilizations and just societies, etc. But all of us, all our progress has depended on the iniquitous system that was set up under the agrarian pre-modern empires, where every single civilization was based on systemic violence, in which 90% of the population were kept at subsistence level and treated as little better than slaves. And we've all benefited from this. We're all standing on the shoulders of the achievements
of violence
in the system. And similarly, in the world, in Europe, we're seeing this horrifying flow of migrants who are literally dying to get into Europe, drowning off our shores every day. And we've created, they see now on their telephones how we live in this utter privilege. And in the 18th and 19th century, we had the scramble for Africa. when Europeans went in, and we went into the Middle East too, and we just carved up this place drew on it to suit ourselves, and now they're coming to us. This the scramble for Europe. They're coming. It's our karma. They're coming back because we benefited from the subjugation of many of these people, and
our standard of living didn't come from nowhere.
No, it didn't. Yeah. And now our deeds are coming back to haunt us. We benefited from it. We are implicit in the violence that was inflicted upon these people, and that have helped to sort of destabilize whole regions.
But violence is inescapable. How do you reconcile that with the peaceful teachings that you write about in religion?
Well, I think what we need, it's because we are polarized beings. We dream of peace, and we can never quite achieve it. But it's important to keep that prophetic voice loud and clear. There were always, from the very first civilization in ancient Mesopotamia, people who rose up against that system and cried out against it. The Hebrew Bible itself begins with a scathing attack on the agrarian system. Adam and Eve are not, when they're thrown out of the garden, they don't fall into a state of original sin, as St. Augustine said. They fall into an agrarian economy. Remember, Adam's told he will have to work with the sweat of his brow from the unproductive earth, which will grow thorns and thistles, and getting a hard living like thousands of peasants throughout the ages. And their son, Cain, the first farmer who builds the first city, is the first murderer. This is a very strong, telling indictment of the agrarian system. This goes on throughout the book of Genesis. The Hebrew Bible is one of the few voices from the other side of the tracks. Most of the great sages whose work came down to us were aristocrats. The Buddha was an aristocrat. Confucius was an aristocrat. Indeed, what we call religious spirituality was one of the arts and sciences of civilizations for the elite. Peasants wouldn't be allowed to sit and do yoga for hours every day in the fields. Their overseers wouldn't stand it. But the Hebrew Bible, you have a strong voice against this system. But even they too eventually have to go to Samuel and say, "Give us a king like the other nations." And they create a monarchy. They create Solomon's monarchy.
Karen Armstrong, thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed.
Again, Karen Armstrong has been our guest. Her book is called Fields of Blood, Religion and the History of Violence.